Hello, good morning, and welcome you with the Biz News Briefing this 24th of October. Have we got a show for you today? Bonus interviews will be with you all the way through till 8 o'clock. But we're kicking off with a company that is back in the news. No, not Elon Musk and Tesla, although at some point in time, who knows, we might ask him to come and join us. Tesla share price up 12% overnight. We'll have more of that in a moment. But EOH, a company whose share price was 165 Rand in 2016, yesterday it jumped 9% to 1 Rand 82. The interim group chief executive is Marius de la Rey. Marius, it's a long way back to 165 bucks, but at least you made a start yesterday. The market liked your financial results for the year to end July.
Good morning, Alec, and thanks for the opportunity to chat early this morning. Yeah, it's a start, but certainly you've got to start somewhere. So, yeah, we've got a plan. It's relatively simple in terms of the execution of it. We started in June when I took over with, re-rationalizing the business that we had. I mean, I think basically we had a drive to get it fit for purpose. It's well documented, our history and what we've been through over the last 5 years, certainly not since 2016 because the share price still ran a bit after that. But, we just felt that we were at a different phase. We had an opportunity to close out two of our big legacy items during the year under review. And so we started with a rationalization of a sort of central group structure that was no longer fit for purposes for the business that we wanted to run. So, good start, but long way to 160, as you say.
But a lot of us who've been watching EOH from the years of massive corruption, and we can maybe just touch on that a little bit later. We have been told that it's being rationalized, that it's being fixed, that Stephen von Collo came in, got rid of a lot of the crown jewels. You still got a 6 billion rand a year business. So you got a proper business still there. But you still, the interim group CEO who took over from another interim group CEO, when is stability coming to EOH and as a result of that for shareholders?
Look, Alec, it's a great question. I mean, certainly that decision is squarely with the board, and the board will get shareholder approval for those decisions. But I think it's all about phases in time and how we try and trade our way back. I think the share price demise has been a catalyst for a lot of the change. I mean, it's fair to say that there's been shareholder value erosion, and as a result of that, for the first time, we've got a lot of involvement from the board, and we work closely with them in this restructure process. Yeah, so I think the board will make those decisions. I have been here for nearly 5 years, and so was brought in originally by Stephen at the time, so I was quite familiar with that reorganization. You talk about restructure and restructure and restructure. Unfortunately, historically, when we had 900 business units and 277 legal entities, we were saddled with debt. So the corruption was one stream that had to be dealt with, but being saddled with debt, we just didn't generate enough operating profit to pay that debt down. So, for the period under review, that rationalization was largely driven by settling debt. We're quite optimistic that with the cost restructures that we've taken out now, we want to trade our way from here out. We're quite keen still to get the debt lower. We're a services business, so while we have manageable debt, certainly not my preference to have debt in a services business, but we're strategically not that keen to sell businesses to get the debt down. We're trying to shape ourselves so that we can trade profitably, reduce that debt, and then go into the next growth phase after that.
Whole new dawn. Let's hope it's not a Ramaphoria, but more of a government of national unity. You're changing your name as well. What's the thinking there?
Alec, I think the important thing about this is, sort of 5 years ago when the corruption scandal broke, we had no idea what it actually looked like. What did it mean? Who was it? How deep was it? Was it, across lots of businesses, lots of, contracts, etc. So we started a journey some time ago where we moved staff contracts and customer contracts out of an entity called Mutombo, which was identified in the ENS investigation as an entity that had some contaminated contracts in it. And so systematically over the last couple of years, years. We've renewed our staff contracts, and we've engaged with new customers using the iOCO brand. So that's been a journey that's been coming for a while. And we just felt that in FY24, it would be a good time with us closing out two really, really large legacy challenges that have been a drag for us for some time, which were the SARS and the Meluketo matters. We settled them with those authorities. That this would be a time to propose to the board that, let's put that chapter behind us and let's forge together as iOCO, which are businesses that have been operating successfully for a period of time, into the technology, landscape that we wanted to. So we proposed it to the board. They were quite amenable to it, but we still have to go through the regulatory approvals, get shareholder approval in November. And then post that, what is important is it's definitely not a light switch change. So anything where we've got commitments in the name of EOH will let down gently and then just sort of turn up the volume on the iOCO brand as we grow. But certainly we've been operating at a customer and a client level as iOCO for some time. So it's not something new.
Maurice Delarey from EOH. And there is a company that has been through the mill. It's a little bit like South Africa. I had a great chat yesterday with Yaki Selea from the Institute for Security Studies, and he said even if the Government of National Unity gets its act together and starts doing the right things, it's going to take until 2030 before we start seeing any improvement on the bottom end of the society in the economy. Man, when they mess things up like they did at EOH, it takes a lot of recovering. We're going to talk in just a moment with Rob Hersoff about something else that seems to be a bit messed up, which is South African rugby. But before we go there, our partners at Bloomberg have got a couple of stories in the news headlines that I want to share with you, because I would also love to get Rob's insights on it too. The one is on a story we ran yesterday from our other partners, the Financial Times in London, which broke it. The issue that Putin is now putting North Korean troops into the front line to fight against Ukraine. It wasn't just an FT speculation. There's a lot more happening on that front. Let's hear.
The U.S. says North Korean troops are in Russia to aid in the fight against Ukraine. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin called the situation very, very serious. Austin also said that what the soldiers were doing in Russia was left to be seen. White House National Security Advisor John Kirby says the possibility of North Korean troops arriving in Russia is concerning.
We do not yet know whether these soldiers will enter into combat alongside the Russian military, but this is certainly a highly concerning probability.
That's White House National Security Advisor John Kirby. Now, officials from both South Korea and Ukraine say the alliance between Moscow and Pyongyang is growing stronger and evolving beyond transferring weapons. Moscow is working to push Ukrainian forces from its Kursk region while maintaining pressure on its front line in Ukraine. Several billionaires have taken sides in the presidential race, but one of the country's richest men is sitting this one out. Bloomberg's Nathan Hager has more from Washington.
Warren Buffett says he won't back any political candidates. The 94-year-old billionaire made his position known in a statement on his conglomerate Berkshire Hathaway's website. It alludes to, quote, numerous fraudulent claims about his endorsements of investment products and political candidates on social media. The world's richest person, Elon Musk, is backing Donald Trump in this race, while the New York Times reported that Buffett's friend and fellow billionaire Bill Gates gave $50 million to the main nonprofit supporting Kamala Harris. Buffett has backed Democrats in the past, but has not publicly supported Harris. In Washington, I'm Nathan Hager, Bloomberg Radio.
And in South Africa, here's Rob Hersoff. Rob, lovely to have you on Biz News Briefing this morning. Before we move on to the rugby story, it reminded me a lot when I was listening both yesterday to the FT and this morning to what Bloomberg is saying about Putin and North Korea, to what Franz Cronier said at one of our conferences with the old socialist or Soviet way was push the bayonet in until you hit steel. And it seems like the West is just a lying mush, but this could be a moment of steel with North Korean troops actually getting involved.
Look, firstly, the North Korean troops have never really been tested in battle. That's a country on the brink of starvation. I'm sure they're sending some of their crack troops. And I actually, in a weird way, think this is a positive thing, because it might shake the West off its rather weak and pathetic posture vis-a-vis Ukraine. whether the North Korean troops can make any difference or not against battle-hardened Ukrainians on behalf of Russians that are kind of running out of manpower, I don't know. But what it might do is trigger other non-NATO countries into stepping up support for Ukraine. And wouldn't it be nice if South Koreans stepped up on the side of Ukraine? Or more importantly, America and NATO allowed the Ukrainians to hammer targets in Russia using the weaponry that they have. And it might trigger that, which would be a good thing. So maybe this is a positive.
Extraordinary world that we live in. That other comment from our headlines about Warren Buffett, who usually backs the Democrat in the presidential election, not doing so with Kamala Harris. Do you read much into that?
I read a lot into that. I think he's saying Kamala Harris is unqualified, incompetent. Her policies are hardcore socialist, and she'd be very bad for the country. Look, nobody likes the character of Donald Trump. You know, he's a narcissist. He's not a person I'd want to have dinner with. But his policies are sound. Whereas Kamala Harris is, you know, has not been proven. She was not elected for this position to run for president. And I think she's very, very bad news. So I think that's the message from the great man in Idaho.
94-year-old Buffett still influencing the world. Rob, you influenced South Africa a lot at the BizNews conference a few years ago. You shook up business in South Africa and said to them, come on, guys, you know, it's a little bit like the bayonet was being pushed in and it was just mush, 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 and you brought some steel there. But on SA Rugby, you're well connected. We had on one of the BizNews channels, WhatsApp channels, someone saying, why don't you ask Rob Herseff? He knows about private equity. He knows he would give you insights into this Springbok deal that's causing so many people so much heartburn.
So I do have a background in sports, media, private equity, and finance. And I have quite a varied career. I worked at Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. I raised a large private equity fund for Africa. I have run, on behalf of Richemont in Italy, what is now Sky Italia, which is a pay television business, where we bought sports rights, we were heavily involved in sports, and I founded Sportle, which is one of my bigger entities that failed, which was in sports rights and media in Europe. And I was the first foreigner to buy a football team in Italy. I don't even follow football. Vicenza Calcio for 2 years, and sold it profitably for Enic. So I know the sports media and private equity world pretty well. And when I was at the rugby in Cape Town, these Americans were sitting behind me and I introduced myself. Hi, I'm Bill Ackley. I'm Ted Ackley. I look great. What do you do? And they handed me their cards. I looked it up. Ackley Sports Group. Never heard of it. Okay, I'd never heard of it. And I know all the sports media investors. So there's CBC, there's QSI, there's Silver Lake, you know, there's Len Blavatnik of DAZN. I mean, there's big, sophisticated players that have been investing in sports and media for a long time. I'd never heard of Ackley. And the Ackley Sports Group was founded last year. And Ackley Sports Group's sophistication in sports comes from their father, who founded a small sports operation in Seattle. They owned a couple of sports clubs. I'd never heard of the Seattle Krakens until yesterday when I had a look. So these are guys that own sports clubs, and they're private equity investors. So, you know, if you were going to choose a partner for Springbok Rugby, firstly, you have to say to yourself, why do we need a partner? Why do we need money? Once you justify a reason, this is why we need the money. We need to expand the brand. This is the kind of partner we need. Then you look around and you say, who are the best partners in the market? And you hire a specialized professional investment banker. You can hire Investec, you can hire RMB. There's some very good people around. Or Goldman Sachs, you know, Richard Nodder, South Africans, top four of Goldman Sachs worldwide. And you could even get them to do it for free because it's a national asset. And they value the Springbok brand, SARU, they do the valuation of the commercial entities. And then they say, right, we'd like to find a partner for 20% of this business at this valuation range. That's how you do it. And then you call up the top people and say, would you be interested? And on the basis of one or two people being interested, you begin the negotiation and you end up with a deal that makes sense. This hasn't happened. This is amateurs, absolute amateurs, you know, who've been brought someone on a plate by Eddie Jordan, who I know very well. And let's just ask a question of Eddie's role. Firstly, I've never in my life seen a fee of 10% on a transaction.
Wow.
Never. As a pure introduction, you get 0.5 to 1%. As a pure introduction. Hi, Saru. Let me introduce you to the Ackleys, great friends of mine, smart guys. I want 0.5%. Maybe I get 1%. If you actually negotiate the deal, and I don't know who he was representing. Was he representing Saru Ackley? Nobody's telling me. Sounds like he was just in the middle. You get maybe 2 to 3 or maybe 4%. And on a massive complicated deal, maybe 5%. Jordan is getting 10%. For what? Who's he representing? That alone makes me think that something that Saru either amateurs or doing something illegal. It's one of the two. Then you get into the detail, okay? And this is where you sort of say, well, hang on, didn't someone buy into the All Blacks? And you have a look. Silver Lake. Silver Lake did a deal with the All Blacks at a valuation, I think, was $2.4 billion, $3.5 billion New Zealand, okay, for a minority stake. Okay, so keep that number in mind. I know Egon Durban, the chief executive of Silver Lake. Silver Lake is the 11th biggest private equity firm in the world. They've been going for over 25 years. They've done over $100 billion of commitments to companies. They own Madison Square Garden. It's a massive sports enterprise. I think APL in Australia. These are experienced, credible, known people. Ackley Sports Group was founded last year. So you start to think, how the hell did this happen? And then I read a couple of articles yesterday that said that Saru spoke to CVC, who weren't interested. Well, I can check that because I know the three founders of CVC. I'm going to call them later. Actually, we should just call Eddie Jordan right now. What was your role, Eddie? Although that would ambush him, and I like him. He's a good guy. This is all the wrong way around, amateur handling, badly constructed. It's a terrible deal. I had a look at it properly yesterday. It's a terrible deal. But the most telling document that everyone should read is this letter from all the unions to Saru detailing what's wrong with the deal. And they did it in a very polite way. You know, doubtful transaction rationale and partner. Well, read between the lines. Why are they doing the deal? You know, commercial revenue growth. Wasserman is already engaged to expand sponsorship and global market access. So why are they getting Ackley in? And on and on and on. Everything is in this letter. This letter is, just read it and you'll get exactly what's wrong with this deal. So congratulations, Gayton McKenzie. Gayton McKenzie called Saru and said, do not do the meeting this week, delay it. Which is exactly what a minister should be doing. It's exactly what the Minister of Sports, Arts and Culture should be doing. Having a look and saying, all is not right in the state of Denmark. And you know, it's a quote, by the way, for those who don't know. And all is not right here. We need transparency. We need to have a closer look. And we need to find out what the hell happened and what is going on. Because this is an absolute joke of a deal. I mean, I don't blame Ackley, okay? Good for them. These are smart private equity guys. And they've rolled Saru over. Whoever was negotiating on behalf of Saru is a joke, is an absolute joke. This is an amateur.
There's a wonderful new program on Disney Plus called Rivals, based on a Jilly Cooper book. And there was a quote in one of the episodes that really came to me. These are guys who kind of aren't doing things above board. And the one chap says to the others, it's much better to be perceived as incompetent than as dodgy. Now, in this case, where would your sense be? Because it's either rank incompetence, as you've said, but are the guys who run Saru that incompetent that they can?
Yes,
clearly. They are. Okay.
Yes, they are. These are amateurs. You know, I had a look at the CVs of a lot of the Saru people. These are administrators, okay? Even the new independent directors, like one went to Rhodes University, the other went to, I don't know, some other South African university. The one guy's in the granite business. And they say, these are really competent business people. They're not. They're very ordinary business people who've been given the role of independent directors and really haven't a clue what they're doing, because they should have had the oversight to say, something's wrong, stop. I mean, Saru are administrators, they're not businessmen, and they're certainly not sophisticated financiers.
So,
you know, This is a national... Look, do I mind a foreign company coming in and buying a minority stake in the Springboks, in Saru, to develop the brand internationally? No, I don't. I think it's a great thing. You know, most of the British Premier League teams are owned by foreigners. You know, it's New Zealand, the All Blacks have allowed Silver Lake to come in. I think it's a good thing. But is Ackley the right partner? I doubt it. They're much better partners. And they're private equity. They're a private equity firm. They're not a brand building organization. So Saru have messed this up big time. And I think this is, chairman and CEO need to be fired at the end of this process. So I don't mind a foreign group coming in, but the terms of the structure have got to be right and the rationale's got to be right. Why are they doing the deal? Do they need the money? If so, what for? List what they're going to use the money for. Okay? Then we all go, fair enough, but let's find the right partner for that. This is not how it's happened.
The Saru board just finally, and let us go along with that process of them being incompetent, have given Zeltmaree a terrible rough ride. He was on our program yesterday and saying he's now been suspended for 10 years, or banned rather, for 10 years. With that means he cannot be involved in rugby in any way. And all he's done is been part of the people who've written that polite letter. Is that your reading of him, or do you think he's also dodgy?
I don't know Zelt, and I listened briefly to the rap yesterday, and I feel sorry for him. They can't fire me. And I tell you what, if you look at the people that signed that letter, there are some very, very powerful, intelligent, honest, decent people on that list. I'll give you some examples. Marco Mazzotti. Marco Mazzotti is a South African, born in KZN, lives in New York. He spent his whole career in New York, and he's the number one lawyer for the private equity business in America. Hmm. He advises all the big private equity businesses in America. If there's someone that knows a private equity deal, South Africa, and is committed, he's put money, he's bought the Sharks, him and Stephen Saad and others, and David Berman. You know, they know this stuff inside out, okay? And then you've got Yanni Durant. He is CEO of Remgro. I know him very well. He's a great friend. He's super smart, and he works for Johan Rupert, who's one of the smartest of all. You know, these guys know this stuff. And the letter they've written is bang on the money. I'd recommend, instead of listening to me, read this letter.
It says
it all. Please publish it.
Yeah.
So what I would do is, Gayton's done the right thing. He stopped the process, okay? They now need to step back, tell us why they need the money, what partner they need, and ask for other bids internationally and locally and handle it properly. And why not call Investec or RMB and say, will you, pro bono, do a valuation analysis and tell us what it's worth? And they'll do it in 48 hours. I can do it in 24 hours. I don't have the time. It's not that hard. So Mark Alexander and his team are definitely incompetent and definitely amateurs, and they've been rolled over by Eddie Jordan and the Achilles.
Well, let's hope that the assessment that Rob Herzog gives us there about them being incompetent rather than dodgy is accurate. Thanks, Rob, for your insights, and we look forward to getting you back again, as you always are, on these big issues. Happy to help us at BizNews. Well, on to the promised news on Tesla and IBM. In just a moment, we're going to be talking to Darren Healy from Famous Brands on results that came out from that company yesterday. But Tesla's shares were up 12% overnight, and here's the reason why.
Lots of earnings after the bell. We heard from Tesla. The company reported quarterly profit above estimates, and Tesla projected a slight increase in deliveries for the current year. We got reaction from Tasha Keeney, Director of Investment Analysis at ARK. She told us the report has something for both long and short-term investors.
The letter is very focused on their cost reduction efforts, and that's great for, you know, those short-term concerns. Long-term, we are focused on the future of the company, which is autonomy and robotaxis. So we're seeing higher full self-driving software revenue recognition. You know, that tells us just how useful these active safety features are.
She is Tasha Keeney, Director of Investment Analysis at ARK. Morningstar equity strategist Seth Goldstein says it shows there is still plenty of demand for EVs.
We saw Tesla return to growth with deliveries, and we see Tesla is ramping up its new vehicles. So the Cybertruck is going to be ramping up production, and Tesla is still on track to deliver the new, more affordable vehicle in the early part of next year.
That's Morningstar's Seth Goldstein. Shares in Tesla were up 12% in the late U.S. session. We also heard from IBM. Quarterly sales missed expectations. Overall revenue was up just 1% to $15 billion. Looking more closely, IBM's consulting business was flat. Here's Bloomberg's Anurag Rana.
Bookings are tied mostly to consulting. So, you know, people sign that deal, but over the next 12, 24 months, that converts into revenue. So you're not going to see that $3 billion translate into revenue quickly. It may take some time. But that's also, we think, 70 to 75% of that is skewed more on the consulting side rather than on the software side.
Bloomberg's Anurag Rana. Now, in terms of software sales, those numbers reflect a gain of 9.7%.
Well, we spent a little time bringing you up to date there because both of those stocks are in the BizNews portfolio. Perhaps another one that could be added in time is Famous Brands. Darren Healy, the chief executive, joins us now. You guys have also been through the mill, Darren. I guess just like EOH a little earlier in the program, you've had your challenges to deal with. In your case, it was a company called Gourmet Burger Kitchen in the UK. Is that now out the system?
Yeah, very much so, Eric. Yeah, we long gone, and I suppose it is the reputational damage for these things just lives on for a long time. But we're back up and running in terms of post COVID has probably been the biggest challenge, and that's really what triggered the big event at GBK. But certainly been tough times, and this half has been a very tough time in SA. And I think we're quite comfortable we've got through it as well.
Well, you've been through the fire, and that's got to add a lot of value to the institutional memory for if you compare it with people who haven't. Have you done an analysis yet on what the GBK acquisition actually cost you? Forget about management time, but overall on the bottom line.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, it depends which kind of maths you want to do, because accounting standards are quite different nowadays with IFRS. But the full purchase price, all we recovered essentially was $50 million from that on the liquidation dividend. So, and we'd taken nothing out at the time. So, essentially, the full value virtually.
And how much was that?
$2.3 billion. Again, depends on how you net up the purchase price, fees, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
You've got to have a go, though, if you're entrepreneurial, and you certainly did have a go there, and COVID, of course, did not give your business either there in the UK or here in South Africa, didn't give you any, or certainly gave you greater challenges as well. Is that now coming out of your issues that you have to deal with?
No, I think, just the recovery from COVID has been slower than we'd hoped generally, I think, across most markets. And that is around the movement of people and just people getting back into their routines, if you want to call it weekends away, holidays, just general movement is good for us. I think we're pretty much back on track now. I think, in some cases we're at pre-COVID levels. There's still sectors that are not where they were. And I think that's going to be, a much slower burn. So, I would say it's probably back to business as usual now, particularly in the SA context with load shedding having, sort of abated. I think we're back to, almost those pre-COVID levels, but there's definitely some nuances that are not going to be the same.
Did you lose many restaurants because of COVID?
Not directly because of COVID. You know, at the time, I think we did a good job of working with franchise partners. I mean, there was the odd place that had to close because of the nature of the trading area. But I mean, certainly the post-COVID, we've definitely seen some demographic deterioration in certain areas, which have definitely closed some stores where we would probably not have thought we would have closed over time. And I think some of that talks to the governance issues in SA, particularly at local municipality. And I think COVID was a big accelerator of that deterioration, personally, from what we can see. A lot of infrastructure deterioration in that time. So I think that's more the knock-on effect than actually COVID and the actual extended closures itself. That part we actually worked, you know, well with. We had, you know, restaurants that were closed, in some cases, 6 or 7 months where they were in entertainment areas. And those are fine again. It's just really, you know, particular CBDs and a few areas like that where the, you know, local governance has declined. So, you know, not directly because of COVID, no.
I ask that because many restaurateurs went bankrupt. I remember an interview with a restaurateur from Pretoria who explained that had it not been for him putting in the investment that he did from his pension, then they wouldn't have had a restaurant anymore. And so he had to use every bit of savings that he had. Within Famous Brands, was it easier for the guys to actually survive than being independent?
I'd definitely say it was easier, but I mean, there's, you know, franchise operators, as in most, also had to, you know, relook their own personal balance sheet. So, you know, again, depending on the balance sheet of that particular operator, they may have had to do a similar thing to the story that you quote. However, you know, it really did depend on a few things. I mean, the one was, did you have insurance of any sort? And that certainly was quite light around the COVID clause, so there was problems there. Landlords were probably the biggest factor in this situation. And where you had landlords that understood and had a longer-term view, you probably had less of a challenge. And then where you were able to access TERS at the time, you had, you know, lots of opportunity to try and help your business. And I think certainly we as a franchise all came to the party. So I would say that if you were in a franchise network, you probably had a better chance of survival. But again, you know, your personal circumstances were critical. And I mean, restaurateurs tend to not necessarily be very P&L focused. They're quite cash focused. So I think we have also done a good job in the franchise industry of helping our guys understand that a lot better.
Well, it's hopefully ready for liftoff now because you've been through, as mentioned earlier, the fire. These numbers, although it's not showing anything to write home about, and as you mentioned earlier, it is a tough environment to trade in. And for those who don't know, we're talking about Wimpy, Steers, Debonair's Pizza, and a whole host of other franchise brands. But are you positioned to benefit from a promised uplift in the South African economy at some point in time?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've got no doubt about that. For two reasons, Alec. The one is all the macro factors that we see coming through historically have been good for us. So, you know, interest rates coming off a high, declining, fuel price particularly, our business is quite sensitive to that. The two-pot system, which is new to all of us, we don't know, but I mean, one has to logically say that it's going to make a difference of some sort in terms of the marketplace. And of course, sentiment and the trend being your friend coming together. And then, of course, on top of that, just our own personal situation as a business, you know, having still quite a significant debt pile in the business, you know, interest rates coming down as they are, our debt is expensive right now, will just provide, you know, relief for money that we're paying away now unnecessarily. So, you know, there's I suppose, two benefits from our side. But we're most confident that consumer income or disposable income will improve. And, of course, the food inflation environment in our case is also stable as well. So a lot of those factors do point to reasons for optimism. But, you know, in SA, anything can happen and you have to be, you know, ready for it. You can't bank the optimism. You just got to, you know, try and find the wave and ride it.
But the 9% increase in the interim dividend must send some kind of a signal. What should how should shareholders interpret that?
No, I think it does send a signal, particularly given that we were very conservative at year end and we took, I suppose, opposite criticism for having cut the dividend, and definitely looking forward, the factors that I've just explained give us optimism around what we're seeing. And we're seeing some of that coming through in September, October, just as when we did the year-end dividend, we could see the pain coming in the 6 months, particularly March, April. Pre-election was very, very tough. And in fact, this interim results is a tale of two quarters rather than a half. There's such a different trend. So, I think we're, as you say, back on track. This was always the kind of growth in dividend that we used to have pre-GBK, really, and pre-COVID. So not a surprise in that sense.
Darren Healy is the chief executive of Famous Brands, and lovely talking with him here on the BizNews Briefing. Well, I did mention earlier that Yaki Salia, the chairman of the Institute for Security Studies, had a fabulous discussion with me yesterday. I'm going to play you a little clip on part of it, which may give you some reason for pause for thought.
The main finding of the research that we've released is first that it's going to take quite a while to recover to the damage that has been done. I mean, South Africa, we peaked in GDP per capita in 2013. On our current path forecast, that is our business as usual forecast, we only get to back to the 2013 level in 2036. That's 23 years of going backward, in a sense, or sideways.
Dwell on that for a moment. GDP per capita, that means if you would take the total economic activity in a country divided by the number of people in the country, that'll give you GDP per capita. So it is probably the most important determinant of a nation's, is it becoming wealthier because of good policies or becoming poorer because of bad policies? It wasn't like in 2013 we were doing that great either.
No.
My word.
And of course, we haven't gone backward. We've gone sideways. We're getting close to it. Now, when we throw everything, including the kitchen sink at South Africa's development across these eight sectors that we model, we can bring that forward till 2030. But 2030 is still, firstly, a year beyond the 2029 elections. So from a political perspective, the most important message from our analysis is that the Government of National Unity, which has really got off to a very good start, and business and civil society and all thinking South Africans are behind that, needs to hold. And we need to build a centrist coalition in South Africa that is going to last for at least until 2034, which is the elections after 2029. Because the ANC has lost its majority. It may get a bit of a bounce back. I think Frans Corneille on your program indicated, and I think he's correct, that all parties within the GNU, but particularly the ANC and the DA, will probably get a bit of a bounce, probably the IFP as well. But none of them are going to get to 50%. There I disagree with Frans, that I think that the ANC is on a structural decline. I don't think that can be turned around. So they may get from 40 to 45% or whatever the case may be, but they will need a coalition partner. What we need in South Africa is a centrist coalition, and the ANC, the DA, IFP bring different constituencies to South Africa. And there is now, for the first time, I think in two decades, real signs of progress that we can work ourselves out of this hole and that we can stop digging.
Well, that is a common theme, isn't it? Lots to do, lots to fix, and let's stop digging. Now, somebody who's trying to help us stop digging is the DA spokesperson on justice and constitutional development, the one and only Glynis Breytenbach. I say that, Glynis, but I loved your book. I absolutely loved your book. And it's almost one of those that gives you hope and uplifts you about people who have courage and who are able to stand up for what is right here in South Africa. And right now, you're on a mission with your counterpart, I suppose, the Justice Minister, Thembi Simelane. Just explain to us what it is that she's done, in a nutshell, that we should all be concerned about.
Hi, Alec. Thanks very much. My camera is disabled. I'm on my phone. Sorry.
No problem. We're here to listen.
Although I have a great, Yeah, I have a great face for radio, so it's fine. Mr. Milani has done a couple of things that are a little dodgy that should concern us all. When she was the mayor of Polokwane, she entered into what she calls a loan with a fellow who has now been debarred and fined for all kinds of nefarious and dodgy dealings with VBS. At the time, he was also a service provider to the Polokwane municipality and had facilitated loans or investments from the municipality to VBS, for which he, of course, received, I suppose he'll say it was commission, but it's really just a kickback. And at the time, she was the mayor, and immediately after the money from the let's call it an investment, to be polite, it's still early, immediately the funds flowed into VBS. She also then received this loan. It's not a huge amount of money in real terms. It's just over $500,000. For most of us, that's an enormous amount of money. But in the general scheme of the kind of fraud and theft that goes on in this country, it's a drop in the ocean. Of which there was no fixed term of repayment. Nothing. It was on sort of a very wishy-washy, iffy kind of a deal to purchase a coffee shop in Sandton, which she then did. The repayment only started when the investigation into VBS and the various financial dealings started, and then was repaid with great alacrity in two or three installments. So, you know, that's... He was not a financial services provider. VBS was not a commercial bank. It was a mutual bank. Being in the loaning of money business was not the business of this fellow. And in fact, he made only two loans, and one was to her. Now she says she repaid it with interest in those two astonishingly quick installments 4 years later. And this coffee shop has since, I think it's been sold. It's certainly not operating at the moment. The minister tells us that the loan was above board. It was an arm's length. She's got all the documentation. She's yet to produce it despite being asked to do so. She's been asked to produce proof of repayment, which she hasn't really done. Daily Maverick has gotten hold of the documents, and they look very, very dodgy and certainly on the face of it appear to be backdated. But the fact of the matter is, apart from that dodgy dealing, where, of course, there was a conflict of interest when you're the mayor and your municipality is investing and then you get a loan from the service provider on that kind of a basis where you don't have to repay for the next however many years, that should concern everybody and it should concern her. But now she's the Minister of Justice and she's being investigated by the Hawks, and it's a prosecutor-led investigation. And so the NPA is involved, and she sits at the top of the pyramid of the criminal justice system. She says, I give an undertaking, I won't interfere, and the investigation will run its course. Well, you know, we've seen this movie before. We saw this movie with the DSO. When they went after politicians, they got closed down. Vusi Corley lost his job because he insisted on proceeding with the prosecution against Jackie Celebi, who was convicted. It's no good to say, I won't do this or I won't do that. A, nobody can believe you, however much you may or may not mean it. But B, there's an enormous, glaring, slap-in-the-face conflict of interest here that just doesn't do our very fragile criminal justice system any good. And if she had any integrity, she would step aside of her own volition. But if she's not going to do that, and clearly she isn't, then the president should, fire her.
If anyone read Terry Matau's report on VBS, which came out a few years ago, this was a common practice, yeah. Glynis. It's not that they found her. There were many municipalities who had to, who were incentivized to put money into VBS because it was a Ponzi scheme anyway. And amongst them was Capricorn, which Paulie van Wyk wrote a fantastic story about a lady called Mariette Venter. Yes. and how she had stepped in to try and stop it. And the minute she went on leave, the mayor, Gilbert Khanyaho, actually made sure that the loan went through, in inverted commas, or the deposit went through. So it's a bit incredulous, I guess, if you know the facts. And from your perspective, and this is really a question I've been dying to ask you, you're a public prosecutor. You were from the NPA. You've gone into politics where the nuances are just sometimes, those of us from outside of politics, just shake our heads. How are you managing to cope with all of this?
Well, 26 years in the criminal justice system certainly either kills you or makes you stronger. It certainly made me stronger. So nothing surprises one anymore, and you don't, the courts are not a place for sissies. So this kind of thing is every day. It's common practice in South Africa. It's staggering. It's the scale of corruption in South Africa is staggering, but we have to start somewhere. And so we have to just keep on chipping away at this massive, massive edifice of corruption. And one by one, dealing with them, it may take, it will take, the rest of my natural life and probably a lot of other people's too. But we have to start somewhere. We cannot give up.
If you were still at the National Prosecuting Authority, would you have a strong enough case to level against the Justice Minister, Thembi Simelane, on the evidence that you've seen?
That's very difficult to say because I haven't seen any original evidence. So I've seen what what Poli has published, and please believe me, I have the highest regard for Poli and the work that she does. She does phenomenal work. And so I have no reason to doubt the veracity of what she's done, but I haven't seen any original documentation. Mm-hmm. Prosecutors are dealing with original documentation, and they'll have a lot more. I mean, they have the ability that Poli doesn't have, to subpoena bank statements, to subpoena cell phone records, to really dig into the shady forensics of the matter. So it's hard for me to say on the face of what there is now that there's enough to prosecute. It certainly looks like it, and I'm a kind of a seat of your pants prosecutor. I quite enjoyed being in court and in the arena, so I didn't really concern myself with crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's. If there was enough, there was enough, and I went ahead. It usually worked. But given that they're understaffed, under-resourced seriously, and that the police are equally, even more, in fact, understaffed and under-resourced, it may take them a little of time to get, this matter to a head. But certainly this isn't a big matter. And there isn't a lot more that's outstanding than what we've already seen. And so I think they must be in a position to certainly make a decision in the very near future.
But it's a big matter if you're working there, because this is your boss that you're talking about. This is the minister in charge of the whole criminal justice system. So I guess
therein lies the rub. That's why she cannot be, at the moment, the justice minister. If she's exonerated, mazel tov, wonderful. Go right ahead. Come back. Do the job. No problem. And if you vacate the position under these circumstances in order for justice to run its course, you come back with your integrity intact. There's no harm done. But under these circumstances, when you cling, like a burr, it's unbecoming to do so. That doesn't help anybody. It detracts from the credibility of the criminal justice system. It detracts from her own integrity. It detracts from absolutely everything. And, of course, the prosecutors are aware of the fact that she's the Minister of Justice. We all know what happened the last time a prosecutor pissed off the Minister of Justice when Vusi Pikoli upset Bridget Mabandla. He lost his job.
Well, DA spokesperson on justice and constitutional development, Glynis Breitenbach, calling a spade a bloody shovel, as she always does. I'm very grateful that we have Glynis in Parliament. And if you would like to know the inside story of this courageous South African, go and read her book. It really is a very, very eye-opening encounter that I thoroughly enjoyed reading it, and it was lovely talking with her today. But this whole VBS story has got deep tentacles. I'd just like to remind you, though, what happened there was it was only because of a law that South Africa had introduced from the United States, which said that those who fess up can get immunity against the crimes that they fess up on, that the whole VBS story exploded. Because when Terry Matau and the investigators were talking to the dozen or so people inside, they had one story. Only when it was explained to them that they can be immune did their story turn 180 degrees around. And as a consequence of that, things started finally coming out. Well, we're going to be talking in just a moment about another issue that's pretty big, and that's in Equatorial Guinea, where two South African engineers, have been imprisoned for 1.5 years because, well, the deputy president, who's the son of the president, has got assets in South Africa which have been, apparently are the proceeds of crime. But before we get there, here's a fascinating insight from our partners at the Financial Times of London on how artificial intelligence is now going to take over, believe it or not, your computer.
Keeping up with day-to-day tasks can be a bit of a time suck, but it's a fact of life, right? Well, not according to AI startup Anthropic. On Tuesday, it unveiled a new computer use feature for its model Claude. It says this tool will enable Claude to basically act like a personal assistant and control your computer. The FT's Christina Criddle has been following this new era of virtual agents. She joins me now. Hi, Christina.
Hi.
So can you walk me through how this computer use feature works exactly?
So most tasks that you can do on your computer, Claude can do for you. And that includes like quite mundane tasks like filing expenses or booking travel. So you would put an instruction into Claude, much like you would if you were interacting with the chatbot interface, and ask it to do a task for you. But the types of tasks it can do now are controlling your mouse and keyboard. So it can browse the internet and do research. It can schedule calendar appointments for you. It can fill in forms. And it can transfer data from one document to another. These kind of tedious things that take us quite a long time to do, but wouldn't take a computer that long to do if you instructed it in the right way.
How unusual is Claude's new feature?
This is the first time I've seen a feature like this. It is quite unusual and I would say a big step. It feels at the moment like every tech company is announcing their version of AI agents, though. Microsoft announced some recent autonomous agents in its 365 product suite. And then OpenAI recently launched developer access to some of its voice models. So one example demoed by OpenAI was where you would ask the chatbot to find you locations that would sell strawberries near you. And then you could select the business and ask the chatbot to order you a certain amount of strawberries for a certain price. And it would call this business and put in the order for you using its voice. And so this is kind of the next frontier. Many of the AI companies are calling it for this technology. But we've yet to see widespread development and implementation into our lives yet.
Christina Criddle is the FT's technology correspondent.
And she was talking with Sonia Hudson from the Financial Times. And we welcome Sean Murphy, who's gone into bat for two South African engineers, Frick Potgieter and Peter Huxham, in a actually ridiculous story, but something that reminds one of what the Russians did not long ago to a Wall Street Journal reporter. Well, that was all over the world, and the Wall Street Journal reporter is back home now. But Sean, how far are we from seeing Frick and Peter back in South Africa?
Alec, good morning, and thanks for having us. Thanks for the support. I unfortunately don't have a definitive answer to that question. We don't know. we don't know how long this process is still going to take. We're expecting, or we're hoping, that there is going to be, you know, some sort of change fairly soon. If we listen to the murmurings of what potentially is happening in the background and so on, We really hope that something's going to, you know, take place very soon. You know, these guys have been in prison now for 621 days for a crime which they have not committed. They were literally at the wrong place at the wrong time. And, you know, interestingly, they were arrested 2 days after, you know, the vice president of Equatorial Guinea's properties, his assets and his yacht was seized in South Africa for a case which is completely different to theirs. It has no bearing on their case whatsoever. So we certainly believe at this stage that they are just pawns in this entire fiasco. And I call it a fiasco because it really is what it is. We don't know how long, you know, this is still going to take.
But at least there was some good news this week that Parliament is now getting involved. How important is that?
Yeah. It's very important. We've always professed and we've always said that both Peter and Frick are innocent. And they'll always be, you know, people, you know, when South Africans go, you know, to Africa and they work offshore and all those sorts of things, you know, and people see this opportunity. You always get people, especially on social media, where they say, you know, if you're going to do the crime, you've got to do the time, that sort of stuff. But in this instance, it certainly is not the case. And the fact that, you know, Parliament has tabled this and they've adopted this motion as well, it endorses the UN's declaration, you know, that they are being illegally imprisoned and should be released immediately. You know, we're obviously very grateful to all the MPs. We're very grateful to Emma Powell as well, who's tabled this motion. And it was a unanimous decision, you know, for them to adopt this, this motion, which is really good. It enforces what we've been saying all along. We obviously also now feel that, you know, Parliament is 100% behind us, and potentially, you know, we could also then, you know, bring government a little bit more to account, especially Durka, you know, and try and find out from them, you know, what it is that they are doing in the background, because unfortunately, the feedback that we get from government or from Durka ongoing is your generic sort of, you know, response. They're doing everything that they can. It has been prioritized. It's getting the, you know, the top attention that it can get. But, you know, we're not really seeing that feedback. And I'll use a simple example. You know, we know that the minister was in New York at UNGA recently. And we've actually written to Durka, to the minister, to the DG, on several occasions, and we had to read about, you know, what happened in UNGA in the Daily Maverick article by Peter Fabricius. And you know, something like that would be really great to actually hear back from our own government and not read about it in a newspaper. So, yeah, it's hugely important for us, Alec.
What are the alleged charges?
They've been charged for drug trafficking.
Drug trafficking?
For drug trafficking and drug possession in that country, which we know there's absolutely no way that could be possible, you know. But besides the fact that, you know, this is not within their character. It's not the type of people that they are. You know, they family men. They Christian men. You know, they have grandkids. They have kids. They have partners back at home. You know, Kathy is. Is Peter's life partner, you know. Sonia is Frick's wife, you know. They've been doing this for 11, 12, 13 years, you know, that they've been going offshore to go and work on the oil rigs. And I know, you know, a lot of people would say, you know, we always say that, you know, you never expect it from the people that you don't think it's going to happen, you know, that'll do it. But in this case, I certainly can say that there's no ways that these two guys would be involved in any sort of drug trafficking, drug use, or anything like that. I mean, their luggage was found, I think it was about 5 or 7 days after they'd been arrested, in their hotel room, still locked. And the charges state that the drugs were found on their person in their luggage. So the company which I work for, SBM, had retrieved the luggage, still locked, you know, with obviously having the hotel manager and the police there as well, not being tampered with, not being open at all. The the badge which they carry with them is a little moon bag, you know, and a little rucksack as well, you know, because their luggage to go offshore is really, really minimalistic because they don't need a lot when they go over. And the images which we saw about the drugs, which is claimed to be found in their possession, is these huge black bags of white powder. Where the heck did they store this stuff? You know, they couldn't. And then obviously, you know, there's certain procedures that need to be followed, getting onto the rigs, getting off of the rigs, you know, there's tests, all those sorts of things. So if you take all of that into account, there's absolutely no way. There's no way whatsoever, besides their character, that they're involved in any sort of drug dealing.
Sean Murphy bringing us up to date on the latest in a scandal is the only way to put it. But it's interesting how sometimes you wonder how these people who brazen it out, in this case the Vice President Obiang, the President's son in Equatorial Guinea, and earlier we heard about Thembi Simelane, what do they think that we think as the public? Are we really that thick? Well, what we do in the media, certainly at BizNews, is to try and open eyes and just to remind those in power that there are many who speak truth to it. I'm Alec Hogg. It's been my pleasure to be with you today. Look forward to being back at 7 a.m. tomorrow. Until then, cheerio.